This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we'll meet a news press reporter who spent more than a week paddling a canoe and sometimes dragging a canoe through the northern Everglades, documenting the adventure along the way. But first, the news press is presenting a summit this Friday in Bonita Springs on the many water issues that we face here in this part of Florida. The 2018 Save Our Water Summit is the second such event that the paper has hosted. The first one was 2 years ago. So on today's show, we're going to get a bit of a preview. To say that water is important to this region's economy would be a huge understatement. From our tourism-driven economy, which relies on clean water for things like boating, fishing, beach-going, etc., to our agriculture economy, which relies on water to grow the wide variety of crops that come out of this area, the need to strike the right balance seems to be like a never-ending challenge, and that's exactly what we're going to try to explore today. My first guest is Catherine Bergerson from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. She's the Communication and Marketing Director there. The Conservancy has compiled a State of Our Water report card, which will be presented at the news press conference this Friday. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking about water issues today, and as always, you're invited to join the conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Catherine, what exactly does this report look at? It's called the Estuaries Report Card. Is it specifically geared at just estuaries?
It is. It's really looking at estuaries because that's where rivers meet the sea, and where freshwater and saltwater mix, and estuaries are among the most productive ecosystems in the world. So many animals rely on the estuaries for food, places to breed, their migration stopovers, and they're very delicate ecosystems. So if we can look at the health of our estuaries, it's an indicator for a much larger system. And so what the Conservancy of Southwest Florida did is create this estuaries report card as a way to summarize the best available information from the Florida DEP about the health of our region's 10 major estuaries. We started in coastal Venice to the north to the 10,000 islands in the south. And what the report card looks at is really the extent of wetlands, conservation lands, our water quality assessment data and hydrology information, and also looks at things like mangrove coverage and impervious surface coverage, how much concrete is there versus what the estuary originally looked like. And so based on that data gathered from the DEP, each estuary received a grade based on two things, wildlife habitat and water quality status.
So is it kind of a moving target, though, to look at these estuaries? Because it seems like they change so much over the course of a year, and there's so many different little things that can really impact these estuaries, because like you say, they're very sensitive.
You know, that's a good question. Of course, there are seasonal fluctuations due to rain and dry conditions, but that's really the way nature intended it here in Florida. And it's the human interaction and interventions that have caused the systems to get a bit out of whack. And so because estuaries are such an indicator of the health of the larger ecosystems, it's important to look at those. And one of the good things, though, is, as always, when there's a human cause, there's also a human solution. So there is hope for some improvement in the way people can help.
So what is the current state of estuaries in Southwest Florida?
Well, so what we did in looking at these estuaries, it really showed that our water is in peril. And if people want to see exactly the grades for each of our 10 estuaries, they are on our website at conservancy.org/report card. To give a brief summary, for each of the estuaries for water quality received a grade of a C or a D. Wildlife quality, the range is a bit better. We do have grades that range from A's, although there is one D minus.
Yeah, there are a couple D minus. There's the water quality surprised me. It's really not good. There are a lot of D's, and there are only four C's. And I'll read down it real quick. Starting in the north coastal Venice, water quality got a C minus. Lemon Bay got a D minus. The Greater Charlotte Harbor got a C plus. Pine Island Sound got a D. Caloosahatchee got a D minus. Estero Bay got a D. Wiggins Pass, Cocahatchee got a D minus. Naples Bay got a D minus. Rookery Bay got a C, and 10,000 Islands got a C plus. That, I would get in a lot of trouble if I brought home a report card like that.
And, you know, that's really sort of the intent of this report card, is to get people's attention. When you see those kinds of grades as a parent, you say, ooh, something's got to change. And that's what we hope, that the community takes a look at this and says, what's going on in our water? And so, you know, people then ask, hey, what is causing these bad grades? And so what we're looking at are pathogens. That's like bacteria levels that are in the water. Nutrients, that's nitrogen, phosphorus, the things that are contained in fertilizer and sewage. And oftentimes people hear the word nutrients and they associate it with something positive. But in this case, it's too much of a good thing. Nutrients makes your lawn grow, but when it gets into our water, it makes those big algae blooms grow.
Yeah, you explained that to me once a long time ago, and it made it make so much more sense. I mean, well, what's wrong with fertilizer? Well, if the fertilizer gets into that water, you explained it to me where the algae grows on the top, and then that cuts off the sunlight to things beneath. And do you mind walking me through that one more time?
Sure. So, right, when we have these big algae blooms, and like we're seeing now with red tide, when those, they'll say that they're, you know, a half a mile long. Well, think about that, is a half a mile that's covering the top level of the water, and then the sunlight can't get through. So that means the seagrasses can't grow. Well, if the seagrass isn't growing, then the manatees don't have anything to eat, or the fish don't have anything to eat, and then that causes a chain reaction up the food chain with a compounding negative impact. So that's something that the people can do. You can control the amount of nutrients that you put on your lawn and things like that. So nutrients is a very is a big one that we're looking at, and that's a human cause. Also, we look at oxygen depletion and dissolved oxygen. So if there isn't enough oxygen in the water, then of course the animals in the water can't survive. Metals in the water like copper, iron, lead, mercury. Physical parameters, so that's like chloride and turbidity, salinity, the level of salt in the water. And then the sixth one is biology. What type of vegetation is growing? Is it growing at the levels that it needs to be growing at? And what are the stream conditions? So those are the six things that we were looking at in terms of giving water quality grades based on the information that we were given by the DEP.
Is this year's report on our water better or worse than the last time the Conservancy put one together?
They really stayed the same. You know, it depends slightly on which body of water you're looking at, and some of the habitat grades actually have gone up a bit. The news in Pine Island Sound was good. There was an increase of about 3% of mangroves, and so that increased the wildlife population a bit. Also in Estero, there was some good news in 2017 when the county voted to purchase Edison Farms and put that 4,000 acres into permanent conservation. That increased the water grade a bit. So there are some good news stories, but on the whole, it's about the same as the report that we did in 2014.
Things haven't moved a whole lot. If you're just joining the show, we're talking with Catherine Bergerson with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida about its latest report card on area watersheds. It's going to be presented this Friday at the Save Our Water Summit that's hosted by the News Press. If you'd like to join this discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. The thing about this report that makes it kind of easy to digest, I mean, it's a very complex subject, but the way that it's been divided by the Conservancy, it's divided into regions, so you can see geographically kind of where you're at and what the area around you looks like. And there are differences between where the water comes from to feed those estuaries, and that's what kind of has a big impact, and then also how developed the areas are around those bays. Not surprisingly, 10,000 Islands area, which is pretty undeveloped, got a glowing A-plus for its wildlife habitat, and Pine Island Sound also got an A-plus for its wildlife habitat. What are those places doing right?
Well, they're doing a few things right. You know, you can increase the acreage of mangroves. Mangroves are nature's nursery is what we call them. Approximately 75% of all big game fish, so if you like going fishing, 75% of those fish start out in the mangroves because the branches and the trees protect the juvenile fish until they're large enough to go out and survive on their own. So by increasing the acreage of mangroves, the wildlife habitat then can go up. Also putting more land in conservation. We just mentioned Edison Farms in Estero. So having those conservation lands that can naturally, where the water can naturally flow and it can naturally store stormwater, those types of things help overall improve the water quality grades and the habitat grades.
It was interesting, though, that Pine Island Sound ended up with an A-plus in wildlife, but they still ended up getting a D in water quality, and 10,000 Islands got an A-plus in wildlife, but then a C-plus in water quality. Those things don't necessarily always 100% correlate. Caloosahatchee got a D-minus on both wildlife and water quality, and Naples Bay got a D-minus on both of those as well. Can you speak at all to the Caloosahatchee and Naples Bay getting a D-minus in both of those categories? What's going on there? Is it overdevelopment?
It is. The Caloosahatchee is particularly problematic because we have changed the natural hydrology of the Caloosahatchee. It was not originally connected to Lake Okeechobee. And when we connected those two and started the releases from Lake Okeechobee down the Caloosahatchee on the west coast and the St. Lucie River on the east coast, we dramatically changed the hydrology and thus the water quality of the Caloosahatchee River. So while the wildlife habitat may be relatively unchanged because of the development and there's not a lot of concrete and those types of things, the wildlife habitat is still somewhat intact, but the water quality, we have intervened to a point that has really damaged the water quality, particularly of the Caloosahatchee. Naples Bay is also because of overdevelopment around Naples and the water that runs off from the city of Naples into Naples Bay has significantly negatively impacted the water quality of that area.
And the wildlife habitat as well. When I'm looking at the water quality stuff, it kind of looks like my math scores from back in the day. And that makes me want to ask the next question. You know, because I never thought I could do well at math, I never really tried to do well at math. So if you follow that analogy, if you don't expect to do well, you'll give yourself a pass to get average math grades. Do you think that we're kind of striving to better our water quality scores, or does it seem like people have kind of given up? I mean, we haven't changed much in the last couple of years.
Oh, right. But you know what? You know, I understand that it can be feel like a very complex topic and people can feel overwhelmed, but there is so much we can do and there is so much hope. And you know, I've said it before, but it is so important. Where there's a human cause, there's a human solution. So of course, yes, so there is hope for improvement and we cannot give up. And that's really what the News Press and Naples Daily News Water Summit is all about, is giving people, you know, the education they need and the tools they need to go out and be able to make an educated difference.
Well, sometimes when people hear these scores and they hear about things, they might blame it or they might feel powerless and then kind of say, well, this is all big business, big development companies and big agriculture, and I don't really have much to do with that. They don't feel like there's much that they can do as an individual. Can an individual make much of an impact? And what kind of things can they do to make that impact?
Absolutely. Each person can make an impact. And there are some simple, easy things you can do, such as minimizing the impact of your yard and the amount of fertilizer, the type of fertilizer you put on your yard. You can convert your yard into a Florida-friendly landscape. So the water that runs off of your yard has the natural systems in place to clean that water before it gets into the streams and the creeks and the estuaries and the bays. Also, truly, stay informed. The Water Summit provides a great opportunity. The Conservancy's Nature Center has great resources to learn about water quality. Visit our website. And then share your knowledge and share it with lawmakers and decision makers who are making those decisions about our statewide stormwater standards or that are approving new developments. You know, when you're talking to lawmakers and decision makers, ask them to fund conservation projects. There are more examples like Edison Farms out there that we can all be a part of. And if people advocate and they put pressure on lawmakers and decision makers, that's where the difference can really occur.
Well, thanks so much. That's all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Catherine Bergeson. She's the Communication and Marketing Director of the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we're joined by an FGCU professor who will be giving a presentation at this Friday's Save Our Water Summit that will focus on water security and the need to find big picture integrated solutions to the many water-related challenges that we face here in Southwest Florida. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We're talking about water on today's show. Not necessarily what comes out of your tap, although that's certainly part of the issue, but more what's in our lakes and flowing through our rivers and streams and into our estuaries. Our show today is a bit of a preview of the News Press's upcoming Save Our Water Summit, which is this Friday in Bonita Springs. My next guest will be presenting at that summit, Dr. Greg Tully, is professor of marine science and chair of the Department of Marine and Ecological Sciences here at FGCU. His presentation will focus on water security in Southwest Florida. Professor Tully, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
It's actually great to have you back because I know you've been here before. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question or a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So for starters, can you reflect on what we just heard about from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida with that report card?
Yeah, I think the part of the problem with the report cards is where you're starting from. If we look at where the system was 200 years ago, there's no way we're ever going to improve to an A on water quality, for example. But I think these kinds of things give us an idea of where we are in Southwest Florida. It certainly spurs us on to try and implement some change in the region. And I think they're valuable in terms of focusing our communities and our citizens on issues that are great concern in the area.
So what water systems in Southwest Florida are most in jeopardy, and what do you think are the causes of it?
Well, I think each is a little unique. I think, you know, Kathy mentioned Pine Island Sound and Rookery Bay. Rookery Bay is a 110,000-acre reserve, which really helps. And one of the things that she's focusing on is the use of restored ecosystems to actually combat the water quality issues. Ecosystems provide important functions, and they also provide important services. Services are things that we can appreciate, things like water quality filtration, for example, habitat for fishery species. She spoke about mangroves, for example. And I think those ecosystem services are something we really value, and they're reflected. Loss in ecosystem services can be reflected in these kinds of report cards.
So when you talk about water security, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think we need to think how water connects. You mentioned previously in your first segment that, you know, we're driven by tourism and retirees. For example, agriculture is very big down here. Our economy is an economy that's based on the water, whether it's going to the beach or whether it's kayaking down the Kissimmee River, for example. Our economy down here is based on water. That's why people come here. But water is connected to healthy ecosystems. Healthy ecosystems help maintain healthy drinking water. Human health is important. That's impacted by pollution. I think, you know, water not only drives our economy, but water is impacted by change. And one of the things that we're looking at is climate change. Climate change is going to impact the availability of water. It's going to impact how much water comes back off the landscape, how fast it evaporates and transpires. It's going to affect human health. A lot of the disease organisms that we think of as causing shellfish poisoning or seafood poisoning, for example, they thrive under higher temperature conditions. So I think we also need to look at how these things connect with one another and think of it as a system. And I've spent most of my life as a researcher looking at individual systems, looking at the Caloosahatchee, Estero Bay, the 10,000 Islands. And that's an important scale to look at to solve some of these local issues. But I think we need to start looking bigger. I think we need to start looking intergenerationally.
Were you surprised by the news in South Africa about running out of water? Do you feel like there are other places that are that close to that kind of a situation with water everywhere and not a drop to drink?
Yeah, it's a global issue. I mean, we have the ability in this country, because we're a relatively wealthy country, to meet those needs with technology. Cape mm-hmm. Coral does that, for example, with desalination, not relying on aquifers as much as they are using ocean water. But water security is actually an idea that's been put forth by the UN, and it actually recognizes that this is a global problem, not only now, but it's a global problem that's going to be a changing target in the future as we refine our projections on what the conditions in the world are going to look like by 2025, 2050.
Mm-hmm. We have a call coming in from Robert in Port Charlotte. Robert, what is your question?
Yes, this is Robert in Port Charlotte. My question, sir, was I am from another state, and I was a water quality guy, environmentally reaching in Oklahoma, and I dealt with water pollution really starting in 1970 in Oklahoma. But at this point, it seems, I mean, Florida has a varied environment and varied sources of point source and non-point source solutions. My question gets into, is there a comprehensive sort of state approach under the Department of Environmental Quality that may look at funding and looking at putting them in different regions? And I live in Southwest Florida, so I'd like to know that the fishing and, you know, swimming areas are clean, but also the water supply is secure. And can you tell me if there's any kind of comprehensive statewide look with perhaps future eyes to comprehensive solutions?
All right. We'll give you your answer offline. Thank you for calling in with your question. I really appreciate it. So, Dr. Greg Tolley, I guess what we're asking is there a statewide comprehensive look at finding solutions to the water issues that we have?
Well, a lot of the work, a lot of the water monitoring, especially drinking water monitoring, is done county by county. For example, there are statewide reporting agencies that can give you indications of water quality. The state also recognizes or splits the different watersheds in Florida into groups and recognizes impaired water bodies. And that's partly what Kathy was talking about this morning. They're impaired for certain types of nutrients. They're impaired for metals. In other words, they're higher concentrations than we think are healthy. And there's a total maximum daily load procedure in the state that tries to set what acceptable loads of certain compounds coming into our systems are. Water is a universal solvent. As each drop of rain that hits a pine leaf in Florida and travels to the ground and eventually ends up in our local estuary picks up lots of stuff along the way, and that's what connects different parts of our waterways. But it also causes problems when it picks up things that are not that the natural systems aren't really adapted to.
And I guess following on his question that he asked is, I know that there are different people overseeing different things in different parts, and I don't know what concentration you have on actual public policy is as you're a professor. But is there anything that kind of connects them all? Because you said it's a global problem. It's also a statewide issue. Is there anything kind of overseeing all of this and having maybe the South communicate with the North?
Well, I think what you're saying is a movement in that direction, and I think that's what we should be doing. Miami and the east coast of Florida has their climate change compact, which is great. I think we're starting to emulate that. In Collier County, we have a new alliance for Collier's coastal resilience, for example. I think people need to start thinking on the regional scale and larger and communicating. There's also movements, the Water Alliance, for example, across the country that are looking to place more emphasis on valuing all water. Not just drinking water, and then it's something we don't want to deal with, but how can we recover energy from treated water? How can we recover nutrients that can be used again so that we don't have to waste water and just try and not deal with the problem?
Well, a lot of it sounds like correcting things that were done in the past where we tried to control Mother Nature as man. The first thing that people think about in this area, really, when you talk about water issues, is the connection between Lake Okeechobee and the Caloosahatchee River. And Catherine talked about it a little bit earlier. But can you give me an overview of how we got where we are with Lake Okeechobee water going down the Caloosahatchee and then creating all these algae blooms?
Yeah, sure. Lake Okeechobee wasn't historically part of the Caloosahatchee River system. That happened to actually drain swamplands back in the 1880s. Hamilton Diston was saw it as a business opportunity to come to Florida to get Florida out of post-Civil War debt, to drain the swamplands and actually open up the swamps to agriculture originally. The lake was then managed in the Caloosahatchee more for navigation. And that is a legacy. The Corps of Engineers does what people tell them to do at the time and our understanding of how the environment works. But I think there's a growing realization that moving toward the future, we need to look less or not less, but we need to modify our thoughts about what we call gray infrastructure, concrete, for example, and look more at green infrastructure or natural-based infrastructure, working with nature instead of against nature and then having to come back 50, 60 years later and correct what we did because it had unintended consequences that we just didn't see at that time.
Well, you said that we were doing things based on our understanding of nature at the time. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like our understanding of nature at this time is adequate to be able to repair what we did in the past?
I think it's getting there. I think what we're doing these days is we think in terms of ecosystem functions, how these things function as a system. Because if they're functioning healthily, they have very, very high resilience. In other words, if there's a disturbance that comes, they can bounce back quickly. And that's what we need to do with our coastal communities. We need to make them resilient. But ecosystem functions are just a part of the picture. They also provide ecosystem services. Mangroves can trap sediments and prevent sea level rise from impacting us as much. Coastal wetlands, for example, can actually drop the amount of storm surge in a hurricane. And of course, we've talked earlier, we have all kinds of filter marshes to not only reduce the nutrients that come into our local waterways, but water's a lot easier to clean if it's not that dirty in the first place.
Well, and we just had last year with the Florida legislative session, they passed the law to have reservoirs created south of Lake Okeechobee and piping the water down to the south and then having it held there. Does that seem to you like a long-term solution that has any green on it, or is that like a gray solution to an old problem?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think hybrid solutions are equally valuable. And I think, one of the things that project is doing is it's looking at getting rid of extremes. When the Caloosahatchee is too dry, for example, we lose a lot of the habitat upstream. A lot of the larvae of important crabs and shrimps and fishes, for example, get bottlenecked upstream and can't go any farther because they get blocked by the Franklin Lock and Dam. And of course, when the freshwater inflow is really charging out of the Lock and Dam, it flushes a lot of important species out of the Caloosahatchee River, which is their natural habitat, and it kills seagrasses due to salinity as well. And then, of course, you get with the nutrient issues that Catherine was talking about earlier.
It kind of seems like a bit of a Band-Aid approach right now just to handle what's going on now that is extreme, and then maybe more of a long-term solution would be more complex.
Well, I think we need to do both. A Band-Aid is okay.
For now.
For now, because it helps, and it helps solve problems that are right now, economic problems, health problems. But I think we really need to wrap our minds around about the long term, looking at what the projections are telling us. Yogi Berra famously said that it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. But we still rely on hurricane predictions, for example. We don't say, there's inherent inconsistencies or uncertainties in the model, therefore we're not going to do anything about it. We still pack up and prepare if we need to. And I think the models are starting to converge a little bit in terms of climate change and how it's going to impact water availability, how it's going to impact temperatures and disease, that we need to start paying attention. We need to start making plans for that and taking action for it.
If you're just joining the show, we're talking with Dr. Greg Tully. He's a professor of marine science here at FGCU, and we're talking in advance of the Save Our Water Summit, which is coming up this Friday. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And we have a comment from Albert Cunho, who called in to say that there are so many people who work hard to get environmental science and related degrees locally to look into these issues, just so the EPA can then say that the problem here will correct itself. So then what's next? An interesting comment. And then it's also another, I want to hearken back to what you were just talking about long-term solutions and looking towards that. But we live in such a short-term news cycle. Do you think that getting people to think long-term is getting harder and harder these days?
Yeah, I think so. We live in a society of instant news and instant gratification and social networks where oftentimes we don't even talk face-to-face. And so I think that's why something like the Save Our Water is important. It's bringing different sectors of the economy together. It's bringing different groups. I would respond to your last caller by saying that's why it's most important for individual citizens to get involved, because the EPA has certain influence from the federal government. The federal government actually appoints EPA directors, for example, and takes the direction of the federal government. That's why it's important for each of us to get involved and to express our concerns to our local representatives and our state and federal representatives as well.
And instead of also being a preaching to the choir type scenario, it'd be interesting to have people that do have questions about climate change and that question science. There are a lot of people that maybe don't believe it's possible. They don't think that the science is solid on that, or they feel like they want to question that. This would be a chance for somebody to maybe, hear from the scientists themselves about what is being discovered about climate change, because you said something about the models kind of converging on that.
Yeah, I mean, we can all quibble about how much sea level is going to rise. We can quibble about how many days over 95 degree temperature we're going to have. Is it 75? Is it 80 versus about 10 or 15 now? We can quibble on those things, but the trends are pretty clear. And they have been for a little while now. And so for those of us in science who are looking at the information, it's pretty clear to us. It's just the uncertainties, are where people, I think, try and throw the baby out with the bath sometimes and say, well, it's uncertain, so we don't know what we can do about it, so let's not just worry about it. That's just not going to work this time. And we need to think about our children and our children's children. And, I think sometimes that's always difficult for us to do. That's always something we can put off into the future. But we're not going to get a second chance with this. Southwest Florida will be dramatically changed if we don't start doing something about this now.
Well, have you looked at the NOAA projections for sea level rise in Florida? It's kind of alarming. Just in 50 years, we're going to lose a lot of places that we've already paved.
Exactly. And it just depends on which model you're looking at and, as to whether it's 2/3 of a foot or whether it's 2.5 feet. But Florida is a very, very low lying, especially South Florida. Once you get away from the central ridge of Florida, very, very low lying topography. And that's why it's especially susceptible to changes in sea level rise. But sea level rise just isn't impacting our beaches and condominiums and homes on the beach. It can infiltrate our freshwater inflow. It can actually pollute our freshwater supplies, as a matter of fact. And again, it can change precipitation patterns. It can make some areas drier. The Southeast is projected by 2050 to be much drier in terms of the actual water that's available for drinking water and industry and agriculture and other uses.
How can sea level rise impact the fresh water that we have available? How does sea level rise impact our water table here?
It actually gets into the aquifer. It gets into the deep Floridan aquifer. So it can actually, if you don't have enough fresh water is being withdrawn from the system, which if you talk to locals, they've that use wells for their water, for example, they have to go deeper and deeper and deeper every few years to get the water now.
Does the salt water sit on top?
The salt water sits on bottom. It's more dense.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it can come in through the bottom, and if you don't have enough pressure pushing it out from the aquifer is limestone. It's got cracks and crevices in it, and it's very porous, and so groundwater can move through that limestone. It's a very soft stone, and if you don't have pressure holding the salt water out, the salt water will come in. And that's an issue that can be very, very important for wells of industry and citizens in Florida.
There are a couple of things that have been coming up in the last couple of weeks that I wanted to ask you about and to learn if maybe those are interrelated with global warming and climate change. Red tide, that's an issue that we face here in Southwest Florida. Naturally occurring, it happens kind of on its own. It's not 100% our fault, but it's exacerbated by humans. How is that?
Well, one thought that's been put out there is the nutrients. Nutrients don't start red tide, we don't think, because red tide starts farther offshore. It's they probably have a seed bank of some kind, cystic stage that's offshore. So they might be – the blooms might be started by some other physical phenomenon, oceanographic phenomenon. But there's a growing concern that when we do have higher nutrients in our local waters, something we call eutrophication, coastal eutrophication, too much of a good thing, as Catherine talked about – then that can allow the red tides to persist and to remain longer. And that's what really creates unattractive beaches. It creates respiratory problems for people.
Oh, and stinky dead fish.
Stinky dead fish.
Yeah.
It can kill manatees and of course, the fishes we already mentioned. So I think that's how human interactions combined with natural systems work against us.
Does increasing heat do something with that at all? Or is that – because the other issue that I wanted to talk about a little bit is a growing number of instances of fecal bacteria showing up in area waters like the Bimini Basin and along Billy Creek. And that's not unheard of. I mean, this happens, it happens naturally. And a lot – they said most recently at near Billy Creek, it came back mostly vegetative bacteria and a little bit of bird and dog and animal fecal matter. But this is happening earlier than usual. Is that a temperature-related thing?
Well, I think you have to separate local kind of acute instances of this, like Billy's Creek, for example, which was very, very high levels, I think 20 to 40 times what they should be, for example, versus long-term, more chronic problems that climate change is going to impact. Projections have demonstrated that in some parts of the world, 2.4 more million people will come down with cholera based on current predictions of temperature rise. And the temperature can increase the rate of Vibrio cholera in this case, of its reproduction and its growth rate, and make it more of a health issue than it is even already.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, taking that band of where things are hot and you have things like cholera and making that more extreme, and maybe these are like little fissures or boils on the larger scheme of things. I know that one instance of high levels of bacteria in a local basin is not the big picture, but are these maybe symptomatic of a larger thing that's been going on and continues to get worse?
Well, I think the global picture is for sure. An individual instance in a local basin, you'd have to look carefully at that.
You're such a scientist. I would want to blame it. Oh, it's completely all of our fault. But a scientist wants to get the data and make sure that they can make a solid link, which is why whenever I have scientists on talking about climate change, it's interesting because they like to point out that scientists generally don't agree on a lot of stuff. But if 99% of them are in agreement on something, that's kind of a miracle in itself. Right? You have to always prove everything wrong first.
It is. And, you know, and one of the things that we do as a scientist is we want you to trust us. And the only way you're going to trust us, I think, is we have consistently good answers that that ring home.
Instead of just shooting from the hip and saying, yeah, probably.
Exactly. There's plenty of other people who will do that.
And
I'll do that about non-scientific issues myself. So
I really look forward to your discussion you're going to have this Friday. What kind of things do you think people are going to learn when they hear what you have to say on Friday?
Well, I think the interconnectedness of water. I think people know how important water is here in Southwest Florida. But I also think, there's some interesting technologies. There's some interesting things in green infrastructure or natural-based infrastructure that I think can help us. But I think mainly my call is for working together at larger scales than we have in the past, working together across segments, crossing party lines, the political lines. This is a real problem, and politics shouldn't be a part of the solution to it. We need everybody pitching in here, regardless of what your political views are. And again, I really think we need to start thinking intergenerationally. This is something that's not going to go away. And Florida, in 2100 will not look like it does now if we're not doing something about it. And that's a legacy that we're going to be held accountable for leaving.
All right. Well, my guest during this part of the show is Dr. Greg Tully. I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us today. It's been a pleasure and enlightening. And I always love an opportunity to talk to someone who, you know, is a real scientist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take another quick break, but when we return, we're going to find out what it was like to take a canoe from just south of Orlando all the way down to Lake Okeechobee. That's exactly what News Press reporter Chad Gillis recently did, along with photographer Andrew West. We'll find out what all the adventure entailed. That's when we return. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Two News Press journalists recently documented their 9-day adventure traveling the waterways from the headwaters of the Everglades up near Orlando through the Kissimmee River and down into Lake Okeechobee. We're joined by one of them today. Chad Gillis moved to Florida in 1999. His bio says that he camped for months before taking a job at the Naples Daily News, where he worked before becoming an outdoors writer for the News Press. Chad, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're a camper, huh?
I camp quite a bit. My wife and I camped just a couple weeks ago in Myakka River Park, State Park. It was really nice, but never have I done any camping like this.
Oh, well, at least you had experience.
That did help.
We've been talking about water on today's show in advance of a Save Our Water Summit that's happening this Friday in Bonita Springs. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So how did this idea come about?
This idea came about during a brief news meeting with executive editor Cindy McCurry-Ross, and she just looked at me and said, I think you guys should paddle the Kissimmee River. And I was like, oh, okay, that's, 130, 150 miles or so. That's going to take weeks. And she said, well, let's do it. And she was serious. So we started planning from there, and it went well.
Were you scared taking stuff on the water? I mean, did you take your laptop? And
We did have a laptop. Andrew had 7 different types of cameras on him. I had just my iPhone and, a few recording devices. We had more gear. It was probably 800 pounds of paddler gear and food that we took.
How many pounds?
About 800 when you factor in the gear, the 2 paddlers, and the food and water. We took our own fresh water. And
yeah, well, yeah, as we're learning, the water may not always be the best. So you spent a lot of time in a canoe, and your travel companion, photographer Andrew West, is he an avid camper as well?
He is more of a triathlete, but he grew up in Alaska roughing it up there, so he's pretty competent when it comes to the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you prepared well enough?
I do. I think we could have done a few things better, but I think we prepared quite well. I spent hours and hours looking at maps and calling people and asking for advice and talking to outfitters and the Water Management District and the Army Corps just so that we could get a feel for it. And
so what did they say when you said, hey, we're going to canoe from here to here and it's 100? And it's, what did they look at you like, really?
Yeah, they looked at me probably like I looked at our editor Cindy when she said it to me. everybody was surprised along the way that we met. They couldn't believe we were doing it and they wanted to go with us. And we just, you know, we met so many wonderful, colorful people along the way.
You know, people don't usually think about the northern part of the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
Had you thought about the northern part of the Everglades that much? I mean, our reporting of it is the Kissimmee River Basin, and that's what feeds in from the north to the Lake Okeechobee. That's all I really know about it.
Right. I was like that. I was pretty much like that, too. I knew that between Orlando and Lake Okeechobee, there was fresh water, and it was feeding into the Everglades system. But I didn't realize how much a part of the Everglades that is. That's if you look at a map and you go 130 miles north of Okeechobee, you're about in Orlando. And if you go 130 miles south of Lake Okeechobee, you're in the Florida Keys. So it's just as big on the north side or just as long as it is on the south side.
Well, what's it like? I'm imagining everything is cemented in canals.
No, it was not. There's a canal that was dug in the Kissimmee River. It was channelized just before the time that Mr. Tolley was talking about. But most of it has either had restoration work or conservation easements bought on the sides of the lakes. So we didn't see much development. We would paddle at times for more than a day and not see a house or a structure or pass a road or even see a boat at times.
Was that a little bit nerve-wracking, not seeing anybody for that long a stretch?
It got to be kind of mentally challenging because we were looking for people to talk to and photograph, and we just weren't coming upon people. But we knew it was going to be remote and that we were going to have days like that. But it wasn't really scary from a danger perspective or anything like that. It was just more of being able to do the job that we were out there to do.
No, I'm not a camper. So, you know, especially in Florida, for some reason, I feel like it's just kind of lesser Australia in that we have lots of critters out there that are more than happy to get involved in your camping life and make you not a happy camper. Did you encounter any of those guys?
Yeah, we had a really, really tough raccoon the first night we were out. We went out to Lake Toho and camped on Mackinson Island. And the supermoon was up that night. It was the second night of the supermoon. And it must have done something to this raccoon because he was very hungry. He ate an entire box of Clif bars. He ate three, I think it was, of my real fancy high-calorie chocolate bars that I was counting on to keep, you know, weight on me during the trip.
Really?
He tore through a whole package of protein shakes. He even bit into my plastic can of Off, and it was all poured out.
Oh, your bug spray?
My bug spray.
Did you have backup bug spray?
No, I didn't. Unfortunately, we didn't get bit by a bug the whole time we were there.
Oh, well, lucky you.
No mosquitoes anyway. I had two fire ant bites on my hand, which I don't really count those. They're not, you know, mosquitoes or gnats or anything like that. But I was surprised that
Watching this raccoon doing his raid? I mean, were you awake for it?
Yeah, I could wake up and he was just a little further than me and you right now. And if I would wave my arms or do anything, he just kind of looked at me like,
yeah, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, what are you going to do? You're not going to do anything. And he was right. I wasn't going to get up and chase him around because he's faster than me.
Yeah, but I don't know. You couldn't even scare off that raccoon.
No. Luckily, they had chemical toilets on the island, which was a structure building. And I had our food in a bucket with a lid, the rest of it, and I put it inside that facility for the rest of the night.
Oh, it's nice to keep your food safe in a public restroom.
Well, it's good to have calories when you're
paddling 20, 25 miles a day. Yeah, you're like, I'm not going to get picky right now. I can't imagine. So how well did you get to know your co-camper, Andrew West?
Well, I know Andrew pretty well. We do a lot of work together out in the Everglades. We've done several projects, but nothing like this. I think we got along extremely well. We never were, cussing each other out or anything like that. I mean, I only threatened to hit him with a baseball bat like once, I think it was.
Which so. Apparently you didn't take because you probably would have taken out the raccoon if you had the baseball bat on you.
Absolutely.
Right?
That would be my first choice.
And the oar, you didn't even think about maybe the oar hitting him with it? No, I'm sorry.
I think it stole one of my canoe paddles too. I really do.
It probably did. And It's probably taken the same track following you looking for more of those chocolate bars.
I want it back.
I want that back. So did you stay in tents then?
Yeah, I had a one-man tent, and Andrew had a tent, and we camped at a few places that we had had reservations at ahead of time, but a lot of nights we just camped at wherever we could find. You know, we found a place called Camp Mac one night, and it's a fishing camp, and we just pulled up in the evening and said, hey, we're doing this trip. Can we stay here? And they're like, yeah, come, you know, set your tent up right over here. So we sat around the fire with people and talked stories and got to know people from all over the country at different fish camps and camp resorts and different parks along the way.
So tell me about some of these folks. I mean, does anybody stand out?
Well, it's definitely a part of the Deep South. It's not as much like coastal Florida here is kind of a combination of Midwest, Northeast. This is definitely the South. Most people were listening to country music, and everyone was into fishing. People could tell you what the weather's going to be like because they're going to have their boat on the water later that day. But it was very, very nice people. Everywhere we went, someone was willing to help us with anything we asked for. I can't imagine paddling down the Caloosahatchee River and pulling up on Sanibel and asking to go if I could just camp somewhere on somebody's yard.
Yeah.
But the people in this part of the state were more than willing. As soon as we talked to them and told them what we were doing, they were super interested and wanted to spend more time with us.
So when we talk about pollution getting into Lake Okeechobee, the area north of the lake that you paddled through is often described as being the source of a lot of it. Did you see any evidence of that, or did you see intensive agriculture along your drive or your paddle?
We saw a few small algae blooms. We had heard of some larger ones on Lake Kissimmee before we got there. So what we saw was a changed ecosystem. It wasn't clear water all the way to the sandy bottom like apparently it was 50, 60 years ago. The water is more murky. And then there's water control structures that you have to go through that are on the south sides of lakes that keep the river, the channel from flowing
like a lock.
River. Yeah, it's a lock, exactly. We had to go through several of those with boats.
So you had to crowd in there with boats that had motors on them?
Oh, yeah. That was kind of scary.
Yeah. Some of them get kind of big.
Yeah.
How big of a boat can they put on those rivers? I mean, is it shallow up in there? Or did you ever run aground?
No. We didn't have any problem with that. With the boat lengths, I would say probably at least 30 feet because we were in with three bass boats and we had still a little bit of room.
Mm-hmm. In the locks. But did you ever have any parts where you had to take the boats out and hike?
Oh, yeah. We had to go around one lock, which we had to carry all of our gear uphill and over this rural road and then back down a hill, probably about 200 yards altogether. And so we carried everything we had.
800 pounds of stuff?
Yep, 800 pounds of stuff.
Well, minus like 30 pounds of whatever the raccoon stole.
Right, minus the raccoon
thievery
scored on us. But, yeah, we were pushing, pulling, dragging at times. Even the first day we went down Shingle Creek. And it was, although the trees had been washed out, there was lots of erosion. So the trees had fallen over the creek and we were in the water pushing it and pulling it. We couldn't get it down the creek. Eventually we turned around and by about 5 o'clock that day, we were right back where we started.
But some of those trees that had fallen, nice. Some of the trees that had fallen over, could they have been part of Hurricane Irma damage or anything?
It looked like to me that it could have been erosion from that. But I understand that parts of the creek have been not very navigable for maybe 20 years or so now. But I really thought we could make it through this one stretch, but we just, there was no way.
So for someone who spent as much time in the outdoors like you do, did doing this as a journalist change anything for you? Did you look at nature differently when you're doing it as a job?
It made it a lot easier. It made it a lot easier to be in the wild because I wasn't focused on being on the wildlife. I wasn't focused on, oh my gosh, is there a snake over here? Or are we going to run into a bear? Because I was taking notes and helping Andrew getting photos. So yeah, I think that made the wilderness kind of survival or whatever aspect of it. I think that made it a lot easier because my mind was always on doing the job that we were out to do. So I was never worried about an alligator crawling in the tent with me or anything like that.
I would have been petrified. It's been so great talking with you, Chad Gillis. 9 days, 134-mile canoe trip recently completed. This story is available online. People can check it out.
Yes, it is. News-press.com.
News-press.com. Definitely go and have a read because it's pretty interesting and very fun. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jim.
We've been doing this show in advance of the Save Our Water Summit, which is happening this Friday, which, by the way, is sold out, but you can get on the wait list for that. You can go to news-press.com and find the Save Our Water site and get yourself on the wait list if you plan on attending that. Today's show was a bit of a preview of that event. Again, sold out, but you can get on the wait list. It's happening in Bonita Springs this Friday, May 11th. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, Rachel Iacovone, and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGC UFM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.